Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We're so glad you're joining us on this Thursday.
You've got big dreams. You want fame. Well, fame costs. And right here is where you start paying in sweat. I want to see sweat. And the better you are, the more sweat I'm going to demand. So if you never had to fight for anything in your life, put your gloves on and get ready for round one.
Oh, you know the voice. You know you said it. You know you said that to somebody. It's the one and only Debbie Allen from Fane, and she knows better than anyone that hard work and success go hand in hand. She's a dancer, actor, choreographer, teacher, producer, and director. She's won 3 Emmys as well as a Golden Globe, and that just fills one small shelf on her awards case. And she's from a family of accomplished women and concerned women who use their positions to help and educate others. We're so thrilled to have Debbie here today to tell us a bit more about the event she's producing and presenting at the Apollo Theater on November 30th. Commemorate World AIDS Day, which is December 1st, of course. Debbie, thank you for coming to the studio.
Thanks, Allison. That was so nice to hear that little voice again. You know, there's only a few people who have those statements that can resonate, like, you're talking to me, you're talking to me, make my day, talk to my little friend. There's just a few.
Right. You will pay for it and sweat.
I got one of them.
That's so great. I want to talk about this event tomorrow, Keeping the Promise, A Million in Care, Celebrating Icons of Dance. This event is multi-layered because you have the advocacy part and then you have the joy of dance part. So let's talk about the advocacy part first. Tell us a little bit about what this is about.
Well, this is about the war that the whole entire globe is in against AIDS. HIV has been sequestered, has been handled, but it's not done. And it's ravishing still through communities and certainly through women and in foreign countries. And this is a global pandemic, if you will. And when in its inception, we lost so many who had no hope of a cure, no hope of survival. And now there are, you know, medicines and things that can help. So for me, it's very personal because I lost half of my dance company on Fame, the young men, Gene Anthony Ray, Daryl Tribble, Derek Bryce, Adrian Rosario. They live in my heart because they were like my children. And it's something that people kind of walk past now and don't really realize that we're still in battle. And so this production of Celebrating the Icons makes us remember, reminds us of the genius that we've been robbed of because of AIDS, but also celebrates the genius of those people who walked with it as long as they could and what they have, the legacies that they have left us. So it's awareness. And while we're doing the show, there is a AIDS Health Foundation, which is an incredible organization, which is really trying to uplift the quality of life of people all over the world. We'll have free testing screenings right at the Apollo Theater.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
People can come and get tested and see where are you in your health status as it regards to AIDS, HIV.
I think there's a generation that doesn't really quite understand how traumatic that period was. We had Ian Schrager in here because of the Studio 54 documentary. Oh. And he was talking about how suddenly all of his busboys and the regulars just disappeared. And Steve Rubell, of course, although he didn't want it publicized, passed away from HIV/AIDS.
Yeah, so many. And there was such a shame. It was like leprosy, and I think we've gone beyond that. I think my Magic Johnson's courage to step forward, and he had to proclaim his infection with this, changed the face of AIDS for people. Because people were running away from people. I mean, I was in the hospital pregnant, watching my children die, and other people were not wanting to be in the room with the same person, can't eat off the plate, not understanding how it's transmitted, what is your, vulnerability to being infected. These things, this has to be relearned again. Where I live in Santa Monica, Elizabeth Glazier, whose children died and she started pediatric AIDS, lived around the corner from me, and our children played with some of the same children. So when my children were like 4 and 6 years old, I had to explain to them about AIDS. They had to know. So this was not something that could be secreted or you can just be a child. No, we've had to grow children up rather quickly because of what's happening in our world.
So what happened? You got a phone call from the organization, from AIDS Healthcare Foundation to your academy? How did this all come about?
How it came about is Michael Weinstein, who is the founder of this organization, and his whole team, they have actually been supporting my efforts in the dance world for a few years because they know that I have access to a community and young people. And even if we're doing the hot chocolate nutcracker, which we're preparing right now in Los Angeles, and it's going to happen, that they could come and have a table that educates about HIV and the AIDS Health Foundation and what they can do is something that I'm happy to provide. So our relationship started years ago, and we are, you know, when they had asked me when last year to come, and I couldn't because of Grey's Anatomy, and this year Samantha Cardberry, who is his executive, said, "Debbie, we want to go to New York in the Apollo." I'm like, "Wow." And, you know, I just know everybody, so I just got on the phone, and I called Misty, and I called
Copeland.
Yes. And I called Robert Battle, you know, Alvin Ailey Dance Theater, and Virginia Johnson of Dance Theater of Harlem, and Alfred Dove, Ulysses Dove's brother. I just called people that I knew, and everybody wanted to participate. And so the show is not long enough for us to really acknowledge all the people that we really could acknowledge, but it's a beginning. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll probably publish something after that just lists names of people that we know we've lost in this world.
And who's going to be honored and remembered?
Well, this is a great group. Alvin Ailey. Mm. Michael Peters, the choreographer for Michael Jackson's Thriller, as well as, you know, Angela Bassett in What's Love Got to Do with It. Rudolf Nureyev, who is just incredible. Ulysses Dove, one of the most incredible choreographers on the planet. Michael Bennett, who gave us Dreamgirls and A Chorus Line.
Of course. I mean,
my goodness. And, of course, the boys from Fame. We're also going to celebrate Arthur Mitchell, who has not, you know, died of AIDS per se, but his company, and that we're in the neighborhood, we're right there in Harlem. We have to have the Dance Theater of Harlem be a part of this celebration. They have been very impacted by AIDS and HIV.
We've come so far in so many ways. What's something you think still needs to be done in terms of the fight?
The education. People got to talk about it. You know, young people are out here being sexually active and they're not thinking. They're not remembering, and maybe they're so too young to even know how rampant this is and how devastating a death it can be. I witnessed it too many times. And yes, there's medications, but, you know, we have to talk about it, and we have to educate our young people and let them know this is still, you know, the killer that's out there waiting to take you. It's indiscriminate. It doesn't know any ethnic or economic barriers. It is a equal opportunity disease.
Education, education, education.
Education,
that's the way to go.
Education, education.
The event is called Keeping the Promise, A Million Lives in Care, Celebrating the Icons of Dance. It's happening at the Apollo Theater tomorrow, November 30th, and Debbie Allen is presenting that. Now, your dance academy, you started the dance academy in 2001, is that right?
Yes, 18 years ago.
What was your original vision for it?
Well, it's what it is right now.
Yeah.
I wanted to, when I started choreographing in Los Angeles and having had the challenges that I had as a young girl getting the training because I was black, I realized every time I would choreograph the Oscars and I would talk about, this is very Catherine Dunham-esque, and they wouldn't even know who Catherine Dunham is, or they might know Bob Fosse. They might, you know, I said, you know, I've got to educate these children. So I started doing something in Texas, and then 1 year Jackie Chan had me teaching his son, and I created a summer dance camp around his son, and I decided to do it. So I realized there's a gulf. There was nothing there that had quite my vision, which is a comprehensive, you know, vocabulary of dance. So we teach flamenco, mm-hmm. we teach modern, we teach ballet, we teach tap, we teach Cirque du Soleil technique, we even teach acting and singing. Just the comprehensive language of dance, theater, arts. And so we have been world recognized. We've traveled to Italy in celebration of Nureyev. We've gone to India. We're going to Cuba. We've been asked to come and participate in a festival. And they come to us from all over the world, which is very interesting. In the summertime, we have an incredible global audience with young people that come.
I don't know if you remember, but you gave me a tour of your studio once.
Oh.
A couple years ago.
Oh.
And
yeah.
One of the things I observed, I loved it. So all these little faces, all these little bodies. And as soon as you walk in the room, they all get real straight. Real posture goes up. And it's Miss Debbie, Miss Allen.
Yeah.
There's a part of this is also about how to present yourself, isn't it, for those kids?
It is totally character education. Mm-hmm. You know, if parents think, you know, this is why I'm not doing competitions. I'm not trying to get them in eyelashes and sparkles and big, you know, awards that don't do very much for them and just, you know, feel the applause. I want them to understand the discipline of the art and that they must strip themselves and look at themselves very nakedly and without all of that and start to compete with themselves on a daily basis and learn how to take direction, how to work with a group, how to be with friends, how to, you know, maybe be marginalized, maybe not be the best one. Learn so you can get out in the world and you'll be fierce. You'll be okay. It gives them an armor into the world that I think should be mandatory for every child. I think the arts should be mandatory in public education.
Your dance academy also added a class specifically for women who've dealt with physical violence.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that class.
Okay. Well, we have many wonderful surrogates that come to us that want to get involved. And there's a woman named Jill Black who's been very involved in the homeless community. It's something that we are determined to be a part of. Mm-hmm. And we're actually navigating a class for that. And she brought to our attention this sanctuary, this home where these women live with their children. And we realized this would be an amazing class for them. It's done in a very private way mm-hmm. because they're shy and, you know, battered, so they don't want a lot of attention or their names called. But it is glorious to go there where they stay in their home in this small place and bring African drums and energy and life. And it is helping them, it's helping them find their voice again through the darkness of their own horrible experience. It's helping them find some light.
And also freedom, I have to imagine, right? Freedom mm-hmm. in their bodies.
Yeah, in their bodies to be open, to feel like it's okay to be open and not to get shut down. It's the openness that's really so great.
We're speaking with Debbie Allen. We're talking about her event at the Apollo tomorrow. We're talking about her dance academy. We stick around, and can I ask you a couple of questions about Grey's Anatomy
yeah.
and the awesome ladies in your family?
Okay, absolutely.
Stick around. You're listening to All of It with Allison Stewart. We'll be right back. Yeah. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and we are back with Debbie Allen. So, Debbie, I know you've been directing Grey's since 2010. Does that sound? Grey's Anatomy, we're talking about. The fans, we call it Grey's.
It's over 7 years.
So, but you're also on the show.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like to direct a show that you're actually also on? Is that, I have to admit that, I have to think it's some kind of challenge to be able to be in the practice of being an actor and then have to be the director.
Well, I actually honed that skill on Fame. Because I was directing Fame, and I was in Fame. And I learned to have a good understudy so that I can see the scenes. I do it first, then I look at it with the stand-in.
Mm-hmm.
and then I can say what I want to do with the cameras when I see it. It's just something I've learned on the way, and maybe because I'm not one of those actors that watches themselves, so I don't feel all precious about what I look like, even though I think I look like a hound dog on camera. I don't have that kind of ego, so I'm not looking at myself. I directed myself when Felicia and I did The Old Settler. I directed that, and it was amazing. And really, I was generous in terms of, I felt it was so much more about her than me. I didn't maybe do as much for myself as I could have, but I thought it was well done. So I've learned to do multitask. I was most versatile in my class when I graduated, and that's kind of stuck with me.
Women can multitask pretty well, though, just generally speaking.
I think we can.
As a dancer and a choreographer, how did that inform your directing when you first started?
Oh, movement. You know, it's called moving pictures. I did the Oscars 10 times as choreographer and also as talent. And the year we celebrated 100 years in film, it was all about that it was motion pictures. There was no sound. And the first time they showed a train coming into the theater, the people got up and ran because they thought it was really happening.
Right.
So choreography is movement, and it is movement. And I was really so good at it that it made me a director on Fame. And directing is movement. Mm-hmm. It is staging. I mean, Kerry Washington used to say that about me on Scandal, because it was just very easy. It was kind of typical to have a scene where you had 9 principal actors in one scene. Mm. How do you do that? And they're not just standing still talking. So I would say, you're going to go here. You go da-da-da-da-da-da. And she said, oh, it's choreography. It's choreography. And so I wear that as a badge of honor. I don't have a problem with that. I think it's a good thing. My sense of movement is part of my skill set.
Now, Shonda, is the internet telling me the truth that Shonda Rhimes is producing a documentary about your family?
No, it's about the Hot Chocolate Nutcracker.
Okay.
Which is my version of the Nutcracker, which is so much fun. And it's a lot about what happens behind the scenes, you know, those kids auditioning, you know, what we go through, the rehearsal process, the whole thing. It's one of the first things she set up with her Netflix deal.
We look forward to seeing that. Is there a story you'd like to tell that you'd like to see as a documentary, or that you thought you might want to direct?
Oh, well, there is one that I'm working on. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, though. But yeah, there's a lot of stories. I would love to see a documentary on the making of Stormy Weather. What was that like with all of those incredible black people at that time, given the circumstance of Hollywood at that time? Who was in charge? How did it happen? Who was the, you know, what? That's very interesting. You know, you got Lena Horne, you got Catherine Dunham. I mean, you got everybody at that time.
Who made it happen? What were the obstacles?
I would love to go back and do that research.
That would be fascinating.
It'd be fascinating.
Also, you could learn a lot about it.
You'd
learn a lot about how to overcome things, about perseverance. I mean, I think there's a lot of that part of history that young folks could use.
They could use it. They really could. Because right now they're so connected with the internet, they're not really looking back enough and understanding the weight of the pain to purge racism out of this country. And now it's like coming back. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like its own disease. You know, it comes, it goes, you know.
And it's also, I was thinking when I was thinking Fame and we were playing the clips and everything, I heard somebody describe themselves as insta-famous. And I was like, that's a problem. that's part of the problem.
It is.
You can't be insta-famous. You have to work hard to have something lasting.
That's what you should. But right now you can get famous from eating a frog. You can get famous for losing weight. You can get famous just for slapping your husband. I mean, this is how people are getting to know. I mean, where did
But it's not even 15 minutes. It's like four minutes now.
Yeah, what is, I mean, this sex tape idea, I don't even understand how that came to be. I don't understand it.
Well, hopefully it'll come to be and it will go to be. I want to talk about your mom for a minute. Vivian Ayers Allen. Ayers Allen. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your mom. She's an amazing woman. In researching you, it's like, yeah, let's talk about mom, too.
It's the truth. My mommy, Vivian Ayers Allen, Vivian Elizabeth Ayers Allen, is a true Renaissance woman in that she came up at a time where she learned to do everything. Beautiful, like Dorothy Dandridge, good looks, could make any dress on the cover of Vogue magazine, could bake an apple pie crispier than anything you could buy right now, melt in your mouth, and was a writer, writing poetry on the level of William Blake. My mom is now 95 years old and still at it. And she is the real litmus test for me and my sister and my brothers. Mm-hmm. She is a poet. She was a concert pianist when she was 15. She wrote a book of poetry, which was considered Pulitzer Prize worthy. But she was in the South, and they were like, you know, put down that poetry and fry some chicken. Mm-hmm. They didn't understand her genius. And everything that we do now is a reflection of my mother, because Mama kind of tricked us into believing that we were geniuses as children and that we had to get out in the world and do something and change things and use our art and our everything we've learned. And she was right. You know, she would take at that time in the television, you could take a tube out of it and it would turn off, and she would make it look like the television was broke. So we would go outside. So we weren't sitting up there. She used to call it the idiot box. So now we have that times 100,000 with all the channels, and now mm-hmm. you can watch it on your phone, blah, blah, blah. When do people have their own thoughts? When do people hear themselves think? And when is it their own real idea? If they don't have that time in nature, in silence, in quiet. That's something that the arts would hopefully reinstill in young people, because you have to have that to get somewhere. You have to.
What is it like when the three generations get together? Your mom, you and your sister Felicia, and then your daughters. Her daughter, Condola, and your daughter, Vivian, both are fantastic actors, have been on Broadway, on television.
I know. Our children are great, and we have sons, too. It's wonderful when we're all together. We had a celebration last spring. Wallace Annenberg celebrated my sister, Felicia Rashad, and I, in what she called it the Tale of Two Sisters. And it brought our entire family together. My mom said we had to wear white, so I went to the wedding shop and bought white dresses. And there we were all together. And it was wonderful, because Mommy always congratulates our success, and she loves it, but she's also our biggest critic. And she'll say, well, why are you doing this? And Deborah, you need to lose a little weight. And I don't know. I saw that episode. I wasn't sure about what you were doing. She is on us. She's in it, and still very much in her own world. She has the Brainerd Heritage Fund, which is in South Carolina, where she has revitalized Brainerd, which was one of the only, is still the probably the final colloquial school that educated blacks coming out of the Civil War. She was mm-hmm. in the last graduating class, and all summer long she holds preschool literacy free programming for wow. all of these kids. I mean, my mom is a force of nature, and I am blessed to have her not just with me, but to be inspired and challenged by her.
That's a strong gene pool.
Oof.
You got going there.
Oof.
Debbie Allen, thank you so much for coming to the studio.
Allison, thank you.
Once again, Debbie will be at the Apollo Theater in Harlem this Friday, November 30th, for the event called Keeping the Promise, 1 Million in Care, Celebrating Icons of Dance. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Allison.
is All of It on WNYC. When Anna Sale, host and managing editor of the WNYC Studios podcast Death, Sex, and Money, first checked in on Hiroki Takuchi and his wife, Rachel, they were just a few months removed from an accident that forever changed their lives. While Hiroki was riding his bicycle around central London, he crashed into an oncoming car, and the accident paralyzed him from the waist down. After major surgery and 5 weeks in the hospital rehabbing, the couple were still learning to cope with the terms of their new reality. A year and a half after their episode was recorded, Anna decided to go back and check in on the couple. They're the subject of the podcast's newest episode, which premiered last week. It's called Married, Paralyzed, and Moving On. And Anna Sale joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Allison.
So how did you meet Hiroki and Rachel? How did you find them?
This is one of my favorite origin stories for a Death, Sex, and Money episode. We actually got an email into our inbox from Rachel Swidenbank, Hiroki's wife, basically saying, I've had this thing happen in my life. My husband is paralyzed 3 weeks after we got married. Have you ever done an episode about this? Because I feel really isolated and I would like to hear something about this. And we said, you know, we haven't, but would you all be willing to tell your story? And they were. And so the first time we talked, they were sitting in their London apartment. We sent a person recording over there to talk to them while I was here in California. And I talked to them about what it was like as they were adjusting to Hiroki being home. His rehab was still going, and what had happened in their relationship 6 months after this traumatic injury.
As you and your team thought about what this episode would be like, what were some of the questions you hoped to answer? As you sort of developed your questions, did you think about, oh, is that too difficult to ask? How do we ask that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the first things that appealed to me about hearing their story was, you know, anytime you're in a relationship with someone, you have unforeseen changes in what's happening in your lives. Theirs was a very sudden change that was permanent. Hiroki's now paralyzed from the waist down, and it happened very soon after they got married. And so they were having to figure out, what did this mean for what the rest of their life would look like together? What did this mean for their roles together? And also, because it's a physical injury, what does it mean for how they move together in the world, what they can do together, how they can be together physically? So I had all of those questions for them.
And there's something was sort of an interesting added layer to their relationship is they were kind of an it couple. In London.
Can you just Movers and shakers.
Yeah, describe who they are and who they were before the accident.
They just were like, everything was going their way. They're in their early 30s. They'd been together for over 10 years. They met at university, and they both had gotten some success in the London tech scene. Hiroki is still the CEO of a financial tech company called Go Cardless. Rachel, at the time of the accident, had her own startup that she was in a fundraising round for, and they just bought their first apartment together. Everything was sort of happening. And then it came to an abrupt pause, and they had to figure out what was going to happen. Hiroki actually was able to take a leave of absence from work, and he has since resumed being CEO of his company. It was Rachel, his wife, who lost her company. She wasn't able to raise the money for a successful fundraising round for her tech company. So after her husband's injury, she lost her job, her company, and has had to sort of figure out her work identity along with her caregiving identity as he's recovered.
You know what? I think we have a little bit of sound from that part of their episode and then discussing it. Let's take a listen.
After his accident, Hiroki was on medical leave. Most of his hospital expenses were covered by the National Health Service in the UK and some private insurance, so money hasn't been a major stressor. When we talked, Hiroki was still going to rehab regularly, but working 2 days a week.
You know, I'm lucky enough that my job doesn't involve any kind of physical exertion, really. And so I'm able to go back, and when I'm in there and in that moment, there's no real difference between me now and me before.
And Rachel, you're not working now?
No. So I was going through an investment round with my company that I was kicking off the week the accident happened. So in an already challenging environment, we didn't raise the money that we needed to in time. And so I shut down the business in December, just as Ricky came out of hospital.
I thought that was such an interesting clip, Anna, because it shows that she had to totally rethink about who she was as well in this relationship, and that how important her career had been to her, and when it was no longer an option for her, what that meant for her own identity. You know, a lot of people think they would concentrate on his identity, but her identity as well.
Yeah, and I actually really appreciated that about them as a couple and the way they have talked about how this has affected both of them. Like for Rachel, all of a sudden being a full-time caregiver has been really hard, was hard. It was a real change to her identity. It was a real change to the roles in their relationship because once Hiroki came home from the hospital, he did need, in the first stages, he needed help with things like being in the bathroom. He needed help with, you know, getting things from higher up shelves. And all of that seems like a thing that a wife and a caregiver is expected to do without complaint because she's loving and that's what you do with for your partner. But I love that Rachel is really quite honest about the ways that that, you know, comes with other sets of feelings like, whoa, what does this mean for me? And what does my life look like now? And they talked about it together.
And also the idea of their identity as a couple, not necessarily talking about sex, we'll talk about that in a minute, but this idea that they were this spontaneous couple who would just go anywhere, and the idea of taking spontaneity out of their relationship because that was part of their identity as a couple. How are they handling that?
Yeah, I mean, in this most recent interview when I talked to them, it had been 2 years since the accident, and they talked about the simple thing of they've always been big travelers, and they've since the accident, they've resumed going on trips. But where they used to be kind of wild, spontaneous, the kind of people who run through the airport, see how late they can be and still get on their plane, that was their style. Now they're the ones who board first. They wait till the entire plane has emptied out. Then they have the, you know, 20 or so minutes it takes for Hiroki to get settled to get off the plane. And just that change of pace in how they move and travel, it's really changed the way that they kind of think of themselves and how they move around. They also talked about, you know, they had this huge group of friends in their early 30s who also traveled together. And they talked about a recent trip to Hawaii where they were sitting along the beach on a sort of boardwalk. And then all of a sudden a group of the friends said, let's go down to the beach and let's get into the water. And Hiroki couldn't get down. There was no accessible way to get down to the beach. He didn't have a beach wheelchair with him. And Rachel having to sort of make the choice of, is she just going to kind of stand and not mention to the friends like, oh, now you're leaving us out because you're making this choice to run into the waves, or let them run into the waves and just kind of silently absorb this is how their lives are different now. But just those small moments, you can see, you know, it's a huge change to both of their identities now being in a marriage where Hiroki's paralyzed.
We're talking to Anna Sale, host and managing editor of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. We're talking about these two episodes. The original episode was called Newlywed and Paralyzed. The follow-up, which came out last week, follows up with this couple about 18 months later. It's called Married, Paralyzed, and Moving On. So in part of the moving on part, let's talk about sex. The issue of sex didn't really come up right away in the original episode. It's something that's more of a focus in the follow-up. Why is that?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, the first episode we talked a lot about, like, what happened in the immediate aftermath. You know, Hiroki is trying to figure out how he can transfer from a wheelchair to a chair. He's trying to figure out how he can, bump up over curbs in a wheelchair, learning how to just maneuver through the world, and also trying to see how much strength he can gain back in his new body and whether any of his spinal cord injury would diminish as swelling went down. In this most recent episode, now they know exactly where Hiroki from here on out, as far as they understand, his feeling ends about mid-rib down his body, and that's going to be the situation. And when I asked them about being together physically, one piece of news that they've gotten recently is that they do, in fact, have the ability to conceive biologically if they choose to. Hiroki's fertility has not been negatively affected. They have to do it with IVF. And so they're like many couples who realize they have to go resort to IVF to get pregnant. they're dealing with that and feeling frustrated that it's not just an easy way to get to have sex. They have to get pregnant. They have to go through this whole process. And they're also dealing with, like, the first phase of getting to get of absorbing the rehab and getting life back in order and trying to reestablish routines. It was all about hitting these milestones of progress. Rachel at one point says, you know, the first year and a half was all progress, progress, progress. And now it's with physical intimacy where they are confronting, this is what's really different. And this is something that this is not going to change. This is a new reality for us. And it changes the way that they were together before. But I did ask them, like, if they cuddle and how mm-hmm. it's changed the way they're together physically. And Rachel talked about before Hiroki was paralyzed, she would sort of put her finger in his navel to kind of, like, all the time, just kind of bother him. Like, and Hiroki said now he will notice that, you know, they're cuddling and Rachel's, like, got her finger in his belly button. He can't feel it. He sees her doing it and it's still a violation and an annoyance. So there's some things that are the same but are a little less annoying than they were before.
I want to play one more little piece of tape. This is actually from Hiroki when he's talking about how he feels about fatherhood, how his idea of it has changed since the accident. Let's listen.
You always picture that you'd have a family and that, you know, it's not like I'd pictured it a lot before, but, you know, you have these images of, based on your own childhood, of, you know, playing with your kids or, you know, exploring with them. But then there's been things that have helped. Like, you know, when I speak to our friend who's just had a baby and he's in that wheelchair and, you know, I think that he said something to me that really stuck with me, which was that, because, like, one of the things that really worried me was that I wouldn't be able to be a proper dad to our children. And I remember talking to him about it, and he said, we were quite drunk at the time, so I can't remember if I remember it entirely correctly, but, you know, he was saying something along the lines of, look, like, that's, you're reflecting your own feelings about how you want to be in the situation, not what your kids would need. And so I think there's a level of, like, you know, redefining what fatherhood means through a different lens. It doesn't mean that it's worse. It's just different.
Anna, final question. Why did you want to go back and check in on this couple?
I wanted to hear what, you know, so often when you hear stories about traumatic injuries, it's someone giving an interview from a hospital bed, or it's someone who's just gotten home from rehab. And I wanted to hear what life was like for them now that their routines are resumed and they're out of the immediate kind of shock of it and are adjusting to real life. And I wanted to hear what that's been like for them. And I just also I love the way they talk. They talk about very hard things with incredible humor and with just, like, unflinching honesty. And so I wanted to hear where they were 2 years after the accident.
You can hear it for yourself at checking out the latest episodes of Death, Sex, and Money on your podcast feed or at WNYC.org. Anna Sale, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back with comedian Janelle James. This is All of It. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Janelle James is a comedic force. If you read the New York Times earlier this week, you saw her picture. She was featured as one of the three savvy comics who shine where sex and politics intersect. In 2016, she was included in the highly regarded Just for Laughs New Faces Showcase. She was named one of the 50 most funniest people in Brooklyn. She starred with Chris Rock, Amy Schumer, and earlier this year, Janelle had a stand-up set featured in the Comedy Lineup series on Netflix. This is all to say the lady is busy. Now she has her own comedy festival, as if she weren't busy enough.
What am I thinking?
What are you thinking, Janelle? You're thinking that you have something called the Janelle James Comedy Festival at the Bell House, December 4th.
4 through 6th.
Oh, that my goodness.
Correct.
How does one get a comedy festival named after themselves?
So, okay, I'm glad you laughed, because either the two ways you can take it is you can laugh or you think this person is a monster. So the festival was previously the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival, and Eugene is also highly regarded. I'm not putting myself on the same level as him, but he's a well-loved comedian. He had that festival for 10 years. The name of it was a joke, you know, hey, a comedy festival named after yourself. And so 10 years, last year being the last year that they were going to end it. And I said, why not take that off your hands? I want a festival named after myself. So, and here we are.
And then you had to make a festival.
I had to make, and now I got to do it. Dang it.
So what?
I just wanted the name. No,
exactly. I just wanted the t-shirt and go home. What do you think? You know, that's one of those things where you think to yourself, you know what? If I ever got a comedy festival, I would do this. So now that you have one, what do you think makes a good comedy festival?
Well, I mean, the venue is always first. Mm-hmm. And so this is at the Bell House, which is like my favorite venue in New York. It's well set up for comedy. It has a good vibe. I was just talking to someone in that you can tell it's been around because even the staff, it's just very welcoming. Everybody's mm-hmm. nice. Everything is well organized. And then, of course, the second thing is who's on the festival? The acts.
Right.
These are all chosen by me. Mm-hmm. I really feel like I know what's funny. I'm a hater as well. So, you know, it's just.
But you're not coming. You are coming to the festival.
Yeah. So the lineup is cool. And I wanted to get, I wanted to represent a lineup that reflects my career in that I do all types of rooms. I do alt rooms. I perform at clubs. I do theaters. Mm-hmm. I'm at the improv with the weirdos. I'm like, and so I wanted all these people that I've met along the way to be on the same show because I think it can be very boring to see the same type of act over and over again, you know?
So tell us a couple of the folks who will be there.
So, of course, Eugene Merman. We have David Cross. We have Cristela Alonso, who is...
she's hilarious.
I love her and a really good friend of mine. Mia Jackson, who is on America's Got Talent. We have Sydney and Marie, who is like a duo, black girl comedy duo. They will be hosting one of the shows. We got Black Thought, who is from the legendary Roots crew, who is like very into comedy, mm-hmm. that's going to come by and do some bits. Nori Davis, so many people that are maybe not, you know, some people who are maybe not household names, but will be. Mm-hmm. And I just want to give them a chance to be seen with... To perform with bigger people and a chance to be seen by people that maybe would not have searched them out.
We talk about this when we're booking this show, established and emerging.
Yes.
We want both.
Yes. And that's what Eugene Merman's festival was for me. Like I had just gotten to New York. I had never been like on the alt scene. I was doing like all the clubs, which is great. But at that time, the alt scene was booming and that's where industry was looking for like the next people and to get TV spots and things like that. And he took me as a nobody and put me on that show to perform with like all these other famous people. And it really helped me out. It really like introduced me to New York. So I hope to do that for other acts as well.
Isn't it amazing how one person's saying yes can make such a difference in your life?
As Lady Gaga said, sometimes it's 99 people or whatever it was she kept saying everywhere, you know, and then if one person believes in you. But yeah, it's true, especially in comedy, a lot of our level ups comes from another comedian, mm-hmm. you know, somebody taking us under their wing or just giving us a chance, you know. But the point is you got to be ready when it happens.
That's true. So folks who don't know your work, you really easily weave political angst with this hilarious commentary. I want to play this piece from a stand-up from Night Train.
Okay.
For that show was hosted by Wyatt Cenac. And in this clip, you're talking about how you deal with racist trolls online mm-hmm. and on Twitter.
Okay.
So let's take a listen.
Twitter, that's what I do. I'm a comedian. And this guy, he called me a gorilla on Twitter, right? I know, that kind of stuff don't faze me. It just made me think, you know, how empty is your soul, you know? Like, where's your sense of wonder, you know? Here you are, you talking to a gorilla. I'm on a computer, I'm typing, you know? I know what Twitter is, why are you not like, hold? The world is amazing, like why would you be mad at that? racists are stupid.
It's just comedy and then fact. Racists are stupid. It's, you know, interesting. I was interviewing Roxane Gay and somebody asked her, well, why do you even respond to trolls? She's like, because it's so easy. It's just so easy and I need to. Why do you respond?
I don't want to put it out there like I'm responding to all these people. That set was done where I would still get like minimal amount. Now it's just like too much. But most of the time, I know I'm always like, this is something that I would never do. So I'm just always interested in their psychology. Like I would never, regardless of how I feel about somebody, search them out to like type mean things at them. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, what's going on with you? Like nobody that's happy is doing that. So it never really affects me because I'm like, your life can't be that great if this is what you're spending your time on. And so sometimes because I know they're sad, I'm like empathetic. I'm one of those people.
Wow.
Yeah. In that joke, I said, I always get racists to apologize to me. Like people who troll me, by the time we finish talking, mm-hmm. by the end of the, they're like, you know what? I'm sorry. They telling me all their troubles. You know what I mean? Not necessarily that's what I'm going for, but I'm always right. It's never somebody that's like, you know, all is right in the world and I just hate you. You know what I mean? So I'm just always trying to just get them to see like, yo, this is not something you should be spending your time on, right, dude. And it's just, and it's silly. You're wasting your life minutes on something that's very silly. I just think that joke is just about how absurd racism is in general. Just a general thought of it is just so such a waste of time to me. It makes me upset that I have to waste my time even thinking about it and being affected by it.
We're speaking with Janelle James. The Janelle James Comedy Festival will be at the Bell House in Brooklyn December 4th through the 6th. What is it that you like most about stand-up? Because I know you write as well.
Mm-hmm. You mean like, well, I write on shows, but I don't enjoy that much because that's an office job. I don't mm-hmm. think people realize that that's like going somewhere, the same place every day. And what I like about stand-up is it's going someplace different every day. So I like the travel. I like meeting people. I like making people laugh. Like that is the basis of it. That's the base level of why I like stand-up. It makes me happy to make people laugh. It makes me powerful. I feel like it's a superpower because I feel like when I'm on stage, I am controlling your emotions. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. That's crazy, and it's powerful. And then to be a woman, a black woman in that position of power, kind of turns me on.
So much of your comedy is personal. It's interesting about your life. It's about your kids. Uh-huh. It's about the stuff that goes. So, are you Janelle on stage? Are you just like a heightened version of real Janelle? Or are you...
I feel like I'm more myself on stage because I can say things that I've thought that I couldn't probably mm-hmm. bring up in regular conversation without people thinking I'm crazy. So so I think I'm basically the same person on it. I don't have a stage persona.
We were going through your Netflix special and can't play that on public radio. Public radio.
Oh,
can't,
man.
It was funny. I'm just telling you, we can't play. And it's interesting because you said you want to explore stuff that wouldn't fly on late night. So what's the line between something that would be on a late night show versus what you can do on Netflix?
Unfortunately, as my mother would say, I have a potty mouth. I do. But I have searched out many articles that tells me that means I'm smart. So so that's one of the things. And also, yeah, I like to dabble in the dark topics, you mm-hmm. know, and figure out how I can make those funny. That's like a brain twister for me. And it keeps me excited to, because these are things that happen, like just not talking about them doesn't make it go away. And I'm not one of those people like there are certain things you can't joke about. That's not true to me. I feel like if it's funny, everybody laughs. You know what I mean? And most people laugh at everything until it affects them personally.
Mm. One of your bits is a sweet, sweet bit about your 13-year-old son getting $30
right.
and then taking you to the movies and then realizing how
expensive everything is. Yeah, those are that joke is just about like watching him grow up. Like, so even when a joke seems and you know they're complex and there's a lot of moving parts to it, the basis of all the jokes are a very basic idea. That joke is about watching my son grow up, basically. You know, and I've taken one piece of it and I've heightened it into a bit, but it's me expressing my angst about my son growing up.
When he realizes that $30 only gets you two popcorns and two sodas and his little face.
His little face. He's forever changed.
He's forever changed. I love this quote. I don't know if you'll be able, you say you want to make white man power moves is what I'm trying to do next.
Yes.
What do you think your next big thing is?
Who knows? I mean, one of the exciting things about stand-ups is you can go anywhere. You know what I mean? So white man power moves, meaning I want to own things. I want to have the power to bring other people up.
That's nice.
I want to be able to say what I want without, you know, worrying about it. You know what I mean? Like those type of things.
You can catch Janelle James at her very own comedy
and
festival.
Wealth.
Janelle James Comedy Festival at the Bell House, December 4th through 6th.
Give me money. Come on out. It's going to be fun.
Thanks for being here, Janelle.
Thank you.